they were dismembered and put in a suitcase. We might be able to find that because it's enclosed in a suitcase. And even if it were to have enough gaseous tissue that would float, it's still going to go to the bottom.
Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know why you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
We are so excited to have a special guest with us today. We have Mark Michu, who is a retired Slidell police officer and certified diver with 30 plus years in experience in recovery diving, who in 2019 started his own nonprofit, Southeast Louisiana Underwater Search and Recovery, which offers his services to families and law enforcement agencies free of charge. He also offers training in water survival and rescue to law enforcement, fire, and other agencies. He is a hero. He is a real godsend to families looking for their missing loved one. He's doing this all really on his own time and out of his own pocket. So welcome. We are so excited to have you with us, Mark.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started with this?
Early in my police career, I ran into a couple of guys I worked with, and we were talking about different hobbies. And they said, we're going diving this weekend. We're going to go spearfishing, shoot some fish, and we're going to do it on scuba. I was like, man, that's got to be expensive. They said, no, not really. So they came back and started telling me about it. And I went to the local dive shop and found out that it wasn't really that expensive. And if I saved my money just a little bit, I too could be a certified scuba diver. So that's where it started at. So late 1994, I received my certification. By 1996, I was getting phone calls to come recover vehicles that went off in the water, different things like that. So as time progressed on, I would get phone calls. Hey, I lost a gun in the river. I lost a deer stand in the river. I lost a boat in the lake. I've lost shrimping nets, false teeth, rings, cell phones, you name it. There's been something that I've been able to find. And as long as I had a good location, I figured out a couple ways to be able to find it. And I started searching, just using things. And some of them are just weighted lines at the bottom to keep me on track, different circle patterns, things like that we would use up until I started into the sonar. But that was after Hurricane Katrina, probably 2007, 2008, somewhere in there. But before that time, I also became the police department diver and started diving for evidence and things like that. And then we actually built a team as time went on with that as well. So it just, I kind of had a knack for working these areas and doing that. And then getting into the sonar is a friend of mine showed me a fishing sonar put out by the company Humminbird. And the unique thing I had there was I was able to take it, find something, anchor the boat, jump overboard and see what it was instead of just wondering what it was. Because not everything looks like it does on sonar, because sonar is acoustic imaging. It's sound that's sent out and then it brings that sound back. And you'll have an interface unit, which could be the unit on that. It could be your computer. It interfaces with that. It translates what it's doing and it creates an image. So to make it real simple, if I'm going over a boat that's sunk and if I've got wind bothering with me and my boat is kind of zigzagging a little bit, the image that I'm going to get back is a zigzagged boat, because whatever the sound hits, the way it hits and returns, it's going to pick up and that's the image it's going to give, which is why sonar is not a photo. It's just an image. So not everything that looks like what you would think it would on there, but you're able to rule that out and say, that's probably it. And then you try to make better passes once you've identified something to clean it up. So that's kind of where I got into these things and doing that. And it started out just some guys I knew at work that they were divers.
Fascinating. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your first experience merging crime and diving, or some highlights, or dig into that? I'm so curious.
Sure. We had a bunch of business burglaries back around 2001, maybe, and they were stealing people's computers. And they sat for a while. We just had no information on it. And that was back before the days we had a bunch of, everybody had video on in their place and things. You'd have burglar alarms, but you had a 60-second delay. Sometimes they have to notify the person to see if they want to send the police out. Then they have to call the police. So you can have quite the delay before the police are even notified to start in that direction. So a lot of that went on. Well, we developed some information that it was a guy across the state line into Mississippi that he was basically stripping them and doing computer repairs. And they told me that we think at this particular boat launch in Pearlington, Mississippi, this is where they threw everything out. What that did for us is if we can verify that information, then we can get a search warrant based on that being good information to go search this guy's house, business, wherever we think that those the rest of that might be. So we got everything together, went over there, got to the boat launch. I went down there, started searching, and immediately started finding tower cases, monitors that were broken so they could sink and things like that, which led us to that. And we made an arrest, and it cleared a lot of cases for us and the St. Tammany Sheriff's Office, because nobody knows where city limits are. They move in and out and stuff. So that was the first one. The second one was a couple of years later. We had a 14-year-old that drowned at our public boat launch, and he jumped off in the water, and until we recovered him, nobody ever saw him again. So apparently, I don't know if he thought the water was shallow or whatever, but he jumped in there and we get the call, and we went out and brought him home to his family. And that was the first body recovery that I had actually done.
What are the limitations of sonar and body recoveries? You know, you hear about people like searching the same waterway over and over and over and over again, and then like 2 weeks later they find the body. And I think the average person just like doesn't understand what is happening in that sort of experience.
That happens very often. Part of the thing is a tool won't do the job. You could buy me the best camera equipment in the world, and if I don't know how to use everything, if I don't understand the f-stops, if I don't understand filters, if I don't understand speeds, the type of film I might need to use in it, if we're talking about a film camera, if I don't know those things, that camera's not going to do the job for me. So we've also been kind of spoiled because Android phones and iPhones take better pictures than expensive photography because they've narrowed that down. But if the sun is behind you and I'm taking a picture of you, you're going to look terrible. If the sun's in your face, you're going to look better. And that's just a minor thing. So sonar is like that too. Most people have a limited understanding of sonar. Sonar is, again, acoustic imaging. It's sound going out, kind of like radar is a radio wave going out, pinging on something. Sonar is the same thing. The sonar that is used is very similar to where if you ladies have children and did an ultrasound, it's the same thing. It uses water as a medium. And that's why they put the gel on you. They put the little transducer on you. And if the baby is far enough away, they're able to get an image, and it has to be on generally one side or the other because you have other things inside of your body that would block that from them to be able to see the baby that's there. It's come a long way since I had children because my youngest is 27. But back then, it wasn't as clean as you could see, but that was what they did. It sent sound in, the sound reflected back, and you were able to get an image of it. But sonar is broken down into three main categories. There are more because they have 3D and other kinds of sonar, but you have side scan sonar. Side scan sonar uses a transducer that sends that out and picks it back up at the speed of sound. Sometimes it's mounted on a boat. Sometimes it's mounted on what's called a tow fish, which is deployed behind the boat, and you can go to depths with that. That's what most people know of when they think of sonar. Let's look at bodies. If you're more than about 20 feet away, there's a good possibility you're not going to see it because you miss it. So if I'm in 40 feet of water and I'm running a boat-mounted sonar, like a fishing-type sonar, which have very good imaging, the problem you've got is you're 20 feet further than you need to be. At 60 feet, a 6-foot man is going to be 1/10 the size. And while I'm moving, if the man is sideways and I'm videoing him from his head to his toes perpendicular, I've got, 18 inches to pick up on real quick. Whereas if he's a 6-foot man and he's laying parallel to me, I've got a better chance of getting him. But as I'm moving, as the boat might be moving up and down a little bit, winds may be wiggling me, I could mistake a shark, an alligator, a big catfish, or anything else for that too. So you have to be able to get back and work it. There's another sonar called a multi-beam. A multi-beam, if you were to look into Garmin and Humminbird, you will see it as they call it a live beam. It sends not just a side image kind of beam, but it also sends, it's almost covered four ways and you get real time. You could see a diver or a fish swimming in there. Problem with that is if you were to put blinders on you or just take your hands and put them like this, that's what you see. So if I move over too far, there's going to be a space that I'm going to miss. So if I'm running a straight line from point A to point B, and then I come over 50 feet, but I'm only covering 30 feet, I'll have a 20-foot hole there that I won't see it. So it's very limited. The biggest use on these, short of for fishing, are on remote operated vehicles we call ROVs, underwater robots, because you look for it and you direct towards it. A lot of times you'll use that as a secondary tool, though there's some guys that do them for a primary tool and do real well. The other sonar is what's called a scanning sonar. The scanning sonar is a lot like side scan, but you drop it to the bottom of a tripod. And from that particular point, without moving, it circles anywhere from 0 to 360 degrees and gives you an image of what's around it. And you just keep moving it until you find what you're looking for or until you clear the area, because if something's not there, you won't find it. The other thing that people don't understand about sonar, or it doesn't really click because it's not been explained, is it would be like if you're sitting in your living room, there's a sheetrock wall between you and the bathroom. And in the bathroom, you're going to have a toilet, a shower, usually a vanity. So if I take a flashlight and shine it on that wall, let's say it's behind the TV, all I'm going to see is the wall. So if something is in the way, those sound beams can't hit and reflect back to it, even though we know it's there. I had a search in Alabama a couple of years ago in a deep mountain lake that was full of trees. We started Thursday night and we worked through the night because we knew Friday morning was going to be a bunch of rain. When I found the man Saturday and I plugged in all the coordinates, I was 20 feet away from the first drop I did Thursday night and I didn't see the guy. So sonar can't do the job for you. You have to know how to, one, operate it, understand what it does. But the other thing is you have to have good enough information to be where the object you're searching for is located. Now, rolling back to the initial question is, why do people miss it? Well, a lot of times they're too far away from it. They're expecting it to do that. I get a lot of new sonar operators that'll send me a picture. Hey, we've got this. We think it's it. And I'll look at the scale behind it. And unless you're looking for somebody that's 32 feet long, that's probably not going to be them. And that particular search in Alabama, I received some of that. So you have to know what it does, how to apply it, and do that. And it's not that difficult. Learning sonar theory, that's pretty intimidating, but you don't really have to know that to use it for search and recovery. But what you do have to do is know what it can do, what it can't do. And one, getting that information to get you where you need to be so that you can find it. A lot of searches I do, all we do is clear an area because I'll get a call from, say, a sheriff's officer, police department saying, look, we've got a little bit of information. Can we check it? We're not feeling warm and fuzzy on it, but sometimes just that little bit of information is correct. We make a find. A lot of times we don't. That's just where it is. But I have all or two of the three kinds of sonar that we use, and I've been pretty good with it, and it helps. I got a call from a search that was going on in Texas, down almost to the Mexico border down there, and a boat had run into a barge. One person was hurt really bad. The other person was missing. The boat was ripped in half, and I had received a couple of calls initially. Well, that's a little further than I can travel with my vehicle right now, but I do a lot of consulting. And the last call that I got on that, I said, look, has anybody been searching the point of impact? And I got no, because the barge kept moving. It stopped down the way, and they think this, they think they're buried in the mud, stuff like that. I said, well, now that some time has passed, you need to get somebody back over there, put some buoys out where you know what you're looking at, and work the heck out of that shallow, no current in their intercoastal waterway. The next day, I believe it was, I received the phone call. They recovered him today right where he was said. Now, this was probably not anybody I talked to. This was probably somebody saying, you know what, we need to go back to that point. And they did. And there he was. But they spent 7 to 10 days searching everywhere else because they assumed that you go somewhere when you go under the water. And most of the time, it's surprising that you don't.
I'm fascinated. So I'm guessing our full of trash, dirty waterways here in Louisiana are perhaps more difficult to search. Is that true?
It can be, but you'd be surprised the places that don't have a lot and the places that do have a lot. We had a 14-year-old that ran from the St. Bernard Sheriff's Office a few years ago, drove down to the East Bank ferry landing, jumped off in the water. When we got out there, they're like, man, this is going to be rough. It's going to be full of stuff. And I looked up the river and I could see the flow of the river ran right through there. There wasn't any debris whatsoever. It was a nice clean bottom. Now, he had swam out far enough where he went missing that he was probably in the deep water where we couldn't search. But at that point, it was really, really clean. A lot of places, there's some debris down there, but it's workable as long as you're above that debris. And some of it, you have to work around a lot of it. But our water is not really any different than most other places until you get to springs of Florida where things are really, really clean and it's spring fed and they're really nice. But for the most part, water is just water. And the toughest ones we were working are some merged lakes that are built for hydroelectric stuff with dams and stuff. So they just fall all of the trees wherever they are to make sure you've got usually about 40 feet of clearance when the water's at its lowest level. They call it pool level. That's the tough ones because you have stacks of trees that they just pushed over with bulldozers. You've got standing trees that just died in place and then fallen trees all around it. Just imagine any of the woods that you can look out and see where you're at and imagine trying to drop something down in between between those trees to see something that might be laying there. You know, that's the difficulty, but we've been able to do that, but it's just slow and methodical, and getting in the right places is the big thing. And then sometimes you'll go somewhere and it's like, we just can't. And then there's been those times too that the electronics, and again, they don't do the job. We had a little boy missing in New Orleans a couple years ago, and we had $100,000 worth of electronics. St. Charles Sheriff's Office had a multi-beam remote operated vehicle, and I had my Mesotech. We searched all over where he was last seen, and we knew we had a big pile of, I called it a mud pile, but it was actually a rock pile. Couldn't find him. Couldn't find him anywhere. We hadn't dived yet because one, it was super, super, super cold. Number two, a lot of these guys were getting new into it to do that. So we were trying to exhaust our other resources first before we put people in this really cold water. When it came down to it, put a diver in and he was exactly where he went in. We'd spent 5 days looking for this kid. The problem we had, some of the info we weren't sure about. But the other thing that we learned from the diver is that he says there are big, huge rocks there and there's a pumping station nearby. So they don't want it to wash out there. And at one time there was a casino sitting there. So it was what we call revetment to keep the bottom from washing out or washing out underneath the sheet piling and stuff that's there. So he said there are big old rocks and he went in between those big old rocks, which that meant the angles from the sonar couldn't get in there no matter where we moved them. And this was a big pile. This was probably 30 feet long and 10 feet wide. But with the best equipment out there, which it really was, we couldn't see this kid. So sometimes the human factor has to come in too. And the way he described it, he said, take basketballs and footballs, put them all together, mix them up, and then put a G.I. Joe down there at the bottom. You just can't get the angle to see it. So there are times that the human factor has to go in there as well. So, I mean, he was recovered. He was brought home. And that's the real world of things. It doesn't just happen. Nobody has all of the resources or all of the knowledge to be able to do it. And that's why we pool these things and mix them up. Because you take a regular dive team at most police agencies anywhere, they might get a couple of call outs a year. They might get a bunch of call outs, but they're all different. And if you've got 7 or 8 people or 10 people on there, how many are going to get the actual hands on, I did this experience? A lot of people are going to be waiting, doing this. So that's where when they bring me in, it brings years of experience working with these others, giving them the experience to do it. But there's a lot more to it when you go under the water than just having the tool or being able to be a diver. I'll always go back to, we have to have information on where it is to be able to find what it is. And sometimes we don't, you know, sometimes we start picking up theories and we work it. And that's the best we've got. Other times we go right to it. Boom, we're done. And things are better from a nightmare.
Do you offer trainings to agencies?
We do. I have two things that I do. One is every month we invite all of the agencies. This month we're actually using Shell in Robert, Louisiana, one of their indoor pools, to work some stuff. And we're going to have probably Baton Rouge Police, East Baton Rouge, St. Charles, NOPD, Slidell PD will probably be there. Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office will be there, and maybe some more. And we'll be doing that on Friday. And we'll be doing what we call advanced body recovery. That's being able to mark, find, put them in the bag, cover their hands, cover their feet, cover their heads to collect any kind of evidence, just in case it's not what we think it is. Because if it's lost, it's lost. And sometimes it is. Sometimes you just have to grab them and get to the surface, because that's the underwater world. But when we don't have to, we need to know how to. So we're going to be doing that. I do those trainings for free. I also have Mishu Consulting, because I'm retired and I have one income coming in, that if they want to learn sonar, search techniques and things like that, then through that, I will go out there. I will go to them and basically, what do you have? And I'll teach you how to apply what you have, tell you, can it work, and offer you resources so that if this is what your budget allows and your people can get good on it, but today we have a search that is kind of out of the parameters of that, then I can come in and work with them with that too, whether it's diving. Now, I don't certify any public safety divers. I have another guy that does that. But what I do is I fill in the gaps and teach them the things that have worked over and over consistently with that, keeping them safe. And the things that you won't get in a structured class that you've got to get, because remember, any class is always, what do you pass? The minimums. Some people excel, some people don't. Some of the people that don't excel so much become some of your best people because they see it differently. So they don't necessarily pass the test real good. But after it's all over with, those may be the best ones in it because they sit back, think, take what you've taught them and run with it. So that's the training that we do. I do a rapid diver training for a lot of fire departments. And that's for car goes in, person goes off. You're in that golden hour that we call it, that there may be a possibility of a rescue instead of a recovery to get you into the water. It's got very limited air, but it gives you 5 or 10 minutes worth to be able to work. After that, you bring in your regular dive teams that have full complement of whether it's scuba, helmet, hose, whatever it is, to go in there and finish up. But it gives them a chance that being the first responders, being there immediately, gets them where they want to be. So that's some of the training that I do. do. I can bring in some canine training from some other people that do human remains detection, which has been real helpful too when we don't have a last seen point.
Fascinating. Underwater stuff freaks me out. So I don't dive too much into it, pun intended. But I have always had all these questions. You know, as a missing persons researcher, one thing that we have seen is if they're missing with their car, they're often in the water.
That's
and
right.
What we see over and over again is like organizations like Adventures with Purpose coming in and just like finding all of these people. And it makes the average person wonder, why aren't the police doing this? You know what I mean?
That's a really good question. And here's why. Over the last 100 years, society has placed so many hats on the police, and they always have to be right, whether it's civil issues in a divorce, whether it's criminal issues, whether it's taking a report, whether it's being in a school, whether it's working a traffic crash, working a fatality crash, working an armed robbery, writing a handicap ticket. You're paying somebody $15 an hour and they have to know everything and be right all the time. So it doesn't leave time in a budget to have a full-time team. Let's take where I'm at in Slidell. We have a lot of water around us, but there's not enough business, if you will, to call for a full-time team that's going to get really, really, really experienced. The other thing is you've got a certain amount of time budgeted to it, because when I left the PD, we were getting on a good day shift, 80 to 100 calls coming in for 5 or 6 people to handle. So where does that leave you time to go out there and spend searching for something when you've got a department that's not very big? And even a department as big as Baton Rouge Police Department, New Orleans, places like that, some of them only have 2 to 5 divers. And those are divers that are doing an extra job. There's generally no sonar involved. Sonar has a big cost to it, repairs, getting to use it. If I teach Sergeant Brown how to use the sonar, and then Sergeant Brown makes lieutenant and rotates out of the unit, then I've got to teach somebody again. And it's not just how to, experience is everything. You know, an experienced teacher, instructor, anything else is going to teach you much more than somebody that went and learned and were taught to teach a program. Ideals are great and we need to have them, but you need people that have dirtied their hands on what they're doing, working on a car, building an engine. You know, if my shop teacher works with me to put an engine together and stands there while I put the engine together, that's fine. But when that shop teacher walks out and hands me a box, says, you got an hour, have it together, that's a whole different thing, because now I'm responsible for it and have to do it. That's where a lot of that comes in. And we've kind of conditioned people to think that government, whether it's a village with a police department or Miami PD, has everything they need. And they've been trained. That's a big thing. They've been trained and certified. Certification is just a start, but they've been trained to do this. Well, that's nice if you're watching NCIS on TV. But the truth is, everything has a learned ability. You can take a plumber in Louisiana and send that plumber to New York, and all they have to do is find out, is there something because of snow that we used in Louisiana that we don't? And that's it. Law enforcement, which is mostly tasked with this stuff, it is more intelligence related. So if I took 4 guys from New Orleans Police Department that have been there for 15 years and rock their game and brought them over here, they know how to be the police, but they don't know anything about the people, who's who. And that's more important in finding out who our criminals are, who our good people are, who the people that'll go either way, depending on a dollar. That is experience and knowledge that's like institutionalized. You can't just hand that to somebody. A firefighter, you pretty much can, because they're putting out fires, but this has a human element. So rolling this back around, the human element of search and recovery or search and rescue isn't just, if you do this, this will happen. You have to know these things. You have to know what's going on. And you could be in hot water one day, cold water the next day, water that's got too much current to be safe in, water that has no current, but that water may be an old sump or something that you have no business being in scuba gear. You may need to hire a commercial crew to come in that is completely insulated and isolated from anything being able to come into them. And I've seen the opposite. I've seen where a lot of teams require that you wear a certain kind of suit no matter where you are. But if that's the swimming hole you grew up in that this kid just drowned in or this adult just drowned in, and it's the same swimming hole that your grandparents were in, it's pretty safe that they're not falling off the face of the earth from cancer or some other thing. They're not growing horns on their head. Pretty safe that you can probably go in there. And if they drowned an hour ago, they're not going to be any different than they are right now if they were still alive with you. So we practice and we train and we teach for biological hazards, medical hazards, and things like that. But the reality is, if you've recovered somebody in, say, the first hour, they're pretty much going to be just like they were when they went under. But we also have that thing, and fire department's really big with that, is how many times are you going to repeat that nobody else would? We used to have a thing in law enforcement saying that this 18 to 20-year-old is going to fight the police or run from the police one time in his whole life. But that same policeman that's 20 25, 30, 35, 40 is going to do this 5 to 10 times a year through the course of their career. So that makes a big difference in what you experience and what I experience. So it's the same thing. How many times are we going back in this water and doing that? So we want to make sure that one, we know about the safety aspects. And number two, how to mitigate it, that if it's September and it's burning up hot and this water's really hot, don't want to put somebody in a suit that totally encapsulates me for something that possibly could happen that could give that person a heart attack, could overheat them, could make it to where they can't think. So there's that balance of training, teaching, and adding the real world into it with experienced people to do. So that has a lot to do with it. So when these other groups come in, going back to that, they don't have all that to worry about. They throw a kayak or a boat in, they go in there, hey, there's a car, they dive on it, we've got something. So there's a lot to be said for that. And in a perfect world with a lot of money, you could have your police departments have an unlimited budget to just go look and hunt these things down. But the truth is, the next minute after that call comes out, another call's coming in, another call's coming in, another call's coming in, and they have to be able to send units to these calls because that's what they do mainly. And people don't understand that. We watch all the TV and we see the things and we think that there's just an unlimited amount of resources. But just like any other business you go to that's shorthanded, there's never enough for law enforcement, sheriff's offices and stuff like that to be able to spend time. Even your fire departments up north that handle their dive teams, you have a limited amount of time and then you got to go back to what you're doing. Plus, handling calls and doing all that, you still have to train. I have a training binder that's 5 inches thick from my time on the job. Every year you do 40 hours of training plus any that's mandatory. So when do you do that? When do you have that? And that's the real world. And a lot of people don't like how that is, but that is the real world. Just like the government making a deal with the devil to protect us from a bigger devil. That's politics. That's the way it is. So these other groups that come through can cover a lot more area on their times. And sometimes they're helpful. Sometimes they get the job done, but they're not terribly helpful either. But that's something I think that they will grow through and learn through over time, because at the end of the day, a loved one was brought home that may have never been found.
Yeah, we know that's the worst feeling in the world. You know, that helplessness, that long, ambiguous loss, not knowing is profound. Right. You know that you deal with the right. Victims and everybody, you see their faces and their families.
We had a search a little under a year ago that one sister was covered. The other sister wasn't. So, you know, you lost two children and how do you get the other one back? The other one, I'm sure, floated. She was small and she probably got missed on the Mississippi River and landed somewhere and probably will never be found. And that's hard. That's very, very, very difficult. And if you're that parent, you've got one back, but where's mother baby? It's a big deal.
What about hold cases? Is it possible to use sonar or any underwater tools if you have a body that you think is in the water, but it's been a decade?
Yes and no is the correct answer. So we got to go back to the biology of humans. This is where it gets a little gross, but we're going to dive right in. Generally, what will happen is a person, if they drown, and I don't mean a cause of death, I mean just the action of what happens, the lungs fill up with water. It sinks you to the bottom. In an amount of time, you will surface. If you're not below 40 degrees, because 40 degrees, you'll never surface, or below 100 degrees, you'll never, ever surface, because the pressure on the body will never allow it to expand and be able to come up. In Alabama, he was 87 feet deep, and it was 53 degree water, and he wasn't going to rise. The combination of the two also kept him there. Now, having said that, in the Gulf of Mexico, as soon as you hit the water, you're on a time countdown of when the crabs and shrimp and stuff like that will eliminate your body and there'll be nothing to float. Other things that happen is I've had several calls. Hey, this was 10 weeks ago. It's September. This happened. I'm going to say July. I don't know if the math works, but we're going to use that. So-and-so went missing. We think he's in this pond. Well, within 2 or 3 days at that point, he would have surfaced. And then the wind would have blown him around, because there's no current in the pond, but the wind would have blown him. And you're generally going to, when you surface, your shoulders are going to be high, but your feet and your arms are going to be hanging down. So whenever you get near a bank or a shore or anything that can catch you, that's where you're going to anchor in. At that point, you're at the mercy of one, just decomposing to nothing. Two, critters getting you. Hogs, coyotes may pull you out of the water, scatter you, things like that. Some of those you're never going to find unless somebody is contained in something like a vehicle or a metal 55-gallon drum that they have probably burned you, because again, you'll float a 55-gallon drum if there's not something kept there. I got a call 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, to go to West Louisiana towards your areas. And we think he's in a 55-gallon drum full of concrete. Okay. So 80 pounds of concrete will fill a 5-gallon bucket. You're at 55 gallons. So just the quick math is this is 800 pounds. How did they get it in the water? If they rolled it down a hill, it's going to go kersplunk and that's it. So you'll probably see it in 1 foot of water just sitting there. And of course, they never thought about it. You get that look like, oh yeah, I didn't think about that. But you could put a little bit in there, but even 80 pounds of concrete in there, you're gonna have to put it out a boat. You're gonna have to do something to get it down. So the things we read about a lot of times don't happen. Now, they have had some recoveries like that. And basically what had happened is they burned the body and there was nothing but bones and they sunk that. We had a homicide near what we call the Green Bridge going across to Chalmette. It crosses the Intercoastal Waterway several years back. It was a double homicide, husband and a wife. And he floated a 35-pound kettlebell when he finally floated. He surfaced with it. So it takes a lot of weight to hold something down, and even a couple of 100 pounds may not hold that body down once they're on bottom. Now, the other side is, let's say we have a boat crash. Let's say there's a lady swimming in the water and she gets hit by a speedboat because she's out where boats go instead of in the beach area where she's supposed to be, which happened right here at Lake Pontchartrain a couple years ago on 4th of July. I was there. The blood was still in the water. Didn't find a thing. The tide was coming in. The wind was blowing out of the east. The next morning, I met Wildlife and Fisheries on their boat over at the Wrigley's to get some gas. We get a call from the sheriff's office. We found her at the end of Carr Drive, which is just west of where she was hit. And she was just like that. She was on the basically on the banks and on the riprap that was there, the concrete and things like that, with a massive head wound. She didn't drown because she was dead. Her heart quit beating. So therefore, she was not breathing and there was nothing to put water in her lungs. So she probably floated out at the surface before everybody got there and were able to see her. So she just followed the tide and the winds that were blowing over there until she hit a point. Now, if she'd have been further out, she may have made it to Lacombe or Madisonville or somewhere like that. So there are a lot of dynamics in there. But just because you die in the water doesn't mean that you're going to sink. Now, if somebody was stabbed and thrown in the water, there may be a hole in the abdomen big enough to fill in with water. But if not, they're going to stay on the surface and move out. And that's a lot of stuff people are never taught. Other things like if somebody jumps off the Mississippi River Bridge in New Orleans, oh, yeah, they're headed for the Gulf of Mexico. When in fact, the last one that I know that was recovered, he was recovered at the Canal Street Ferry landing, and he jumped just about where the cruise ships are. And that was like 4 months later because it was very cold and the water had to warm up enough. So generally where you go down, we call it a descent angle, which is usually whatever the depth is the distance away that you could possibly go, especially if there's current involved. And it can go further if you've got heavy current. It could take you a minute or two to get to bottom. But for the most part, you're going to be pretty much in the area where you went in, unless there's other mitigating circumstances. In the Mississippi River, even in the Pearl, where we have a lot of current, one of our pearls, the West Pearl, the bottom is like concrete out middle because that flow is just sweeping through. But as you get towards the banks, it builds up silt. Well, we're lighter than that, so we will generally get pushed over that way if we went down the middle to the side there where it starts to rise because we are lighter than that. But somebody being in there, a lot of times we just assume that, okay, they're gone. They went way down river. Now, you've also had some that we imaged. We were able to image the young lady that jumped off the Mississippi River Bridge. She was an LSU student a couple of years ago. We used some canine, got an image, but she was in 90 feet of water and the water was 65 feet above normal. Wildlife and Fisheries was out there too. And one of their agents calls me, say, Mr. Mark, did you get something over there? I said, maybe. And again, my sonar, I could only put 40 feet down and this was 90 feet of water because I only had that much cable. He says, I think I did too. So he come tied up alongside of us and we got the same image in the same spot. The two guys from East Baton Rouge Parish just kind of looked at each other and I'm like, what? They said in the summer when somebody jumps off, this is about where they generally end up and they float behind these barges. The next morning, she was 40 miles downriver. How did that happen? Because enough time had passed, she floated. The current was running about 10 miles an hour. 4 to 6 hours, you're just going to follow the river right on down there until you bump into something wherever and get there. So they were like, well, she wasn't even there. She was, well, she was. But the problem is once you surface, you've got a whole nother set of search dynamics because now, let's say in Lake Pontchartrain, you might have wind blowing you. You might have a strong tide pulling out. So that can move you once you go to the surface. But on bottom, you're generally pretty much about where you went until you get in the surf. Grand Isle, Orange Beach, the Atlantic coast. Once you get out there, you've got surf pulling in and out like a washing machine. And we found drowning victims in Venice and Grand Isle that came from Orange Beach.
Wow.
Because they surface and they go. But the incoming water and outgoing water is so strong that it just rolls them away. Rip currents will pull you out. So that's a whole different beast than inland waters. And I don't fool with a lot of those kind of searches because by the time I could get there, everything's changed. I've had this. They were dismembered and put in a suitcase. Yeah, we might be able to find that because it's enclosed in a suitcase. And even if it were to have enough gaseous tissue that would float, it's still going to go to the bottom. So, or the suitcase is going to be right there. And a lot of people wouldn't know. Just walk over there and see if you can find it. Cold cases sometimes, unless they're in a car, a boat, where you've got some real good information that they're contained, you have a limited amount of time to be able to do it. One other thing is in the cold water, they a body will do what's called, it's called saponification. The old term was soapify, and we learned that from using hog fat to make soap. So what'll happen is your tissues will wax up from that cold and the pressure, and you're decomposing, but you're decomposing at a very small rate, not enough to blow you up, bring you to the surface. So when you get that, it becomes more difficult for sonar to be able to reflect off your body, bones, things like that, that would be there. And you would almost have to have a good area, a line of sight with a camera or divers to find something like that. It can be done, but it really makes it a lot more difficult than when somebody has just been in there, let's say a year or less. And you could saponify in a year, but you would still try that. And at that point, maybe the only thing you could see would be the shadows as opposed to actually seeing a body. Some of the training dummies we use are so slick that you get the perfect shadow. And I believe I sent you an image of the guy down there in the Gulf of Mexico. His shadow looked just like a scuba diver. You couldn't make out his body because the stuff he was wearing was absorbing the sound and it couldn't reflect and send it back. But we got the shadow. So if you get the right angle, you can shadow a body that's been in the cold water a long time. But most of the good recoveries have actually been done on video with remote operated vehicles.
Wow.
How often do you stumble upon something you didn't expect or wasn't the goal or the intention? Does that ever happen?
I've done some diving and I found some guns that weren't the guns I was looking for. But for the most part, unless you find cars or something that were at a launch you decide to go search at, which happens. And it happens more often now because you've got fishermen using these things. And some of these bass fishermen are actually jumping off topic a little bit, are some of your best resources when you don't have electronics. These guys can put you on a weed bed and know that, hey, this is a bunch of weeds, fish like the fish here. So like they can see it. So sometimes it's good to grab these guys up, jump on board with them and say, hey, can you search this area for me? But cars are your biggest things that you end up finding. There's a joke I use that the insurance wires either get hot or wet. They catch them on fire or they throw them in the water. And not too many times do you find a car with a body in it that's missing, but they happen. More than not, you just find somebody that either one, they couldn't pay the note anymore, so they made an insurance claim and killed the car note, or they found out that their car wasn't worth as much on a trade-in as it would be if they took an insurance payoff on. So they get that and go buy a new car. But you'll find your places. And then I've had three or four places around here that we found probably 5 to 6 more cars in a certain area. And then our sheriff's office back before Hurricane Katrina, they found a missing guy in about 40 cars at the state line in Burlington on the Louisiana side, where they've just been dumping cars off forever.
Like an underwater now, city.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have the means to search for those before or to even think to search there. And now you've got some sonar and you've got things, which this was actually a search for a car that had just gone in. And they were like, wait a minute, there's cars everywhere. So, and there's a place in Alabama, I forget the name of it, but it's something island. It's up on a river and they have a bunch of cars in there that have been there since like the 1960s. A lot of times when we image a body, they look like they're a pirate. They only have one leg and half of another leg because a knee might be bent up a little bit and it's blocking the other one. So the sound can't get to that. So it looks like their leg's been cut off. So the big thing is you get an idea of what the bottom looks like and then what doesn't belong there.
It's a shame that there's so many vehicles apparently underwater because we know that you're in need of a vehicle, a new vehicle, as well as a new boat. And I want to ask how people can get involved and support your cause and donate. So first of all, how can people donate to your cause? I know there's the Facebook page that we can follow and the GoFundMe. And then what kind of vehicle are you looking for that would suit your needs and what kind of boat, if there's anyone listening?
All right. So to start with, the first question is how to donate. There's two ways. Facebook always has a way you could donate and donate money to through there. I don't have a GoFundMe active at the moment, but I do have PayPal. And with PayPal, it's Sela Usar, SelaUsar at charter.net. And if you donate through friends and family, they don't charge any fees for it. That's a good way to help funds to come in to help be able to, like I say, move about the country if I need a hotel or gas money. And there's still a lot of times that I've just filled my tank up and I got to run across the lake to do something. I come back, I don't even put in for that. And then there's other times that I use the gas money when I need to, but I try to hang on to that because I may have to go somewhere that's going to cost. Those are the two easiest ways to be able to donate. Far as a vehicle goes, I've been using my personal vehicle and I've already put an engine in it, just spent about $500 or $600 in the last few weeks of my own to do that. And that's what I depend on. So I limit my searches right now to probably 4 or 5 hours. But what I have right now is I have a 07 Chevrolet Silverado. It's got 4 doors and it's got the short bed on it. That is ideal for what I need because I can put my sonar equipment, anything else I need in there, and I can drive onto a beach. But that's my biggest need more than anything is a vehicle to make sure, because if this goes out, I'm going to have to say no a whole lot. And again, I'm burning up my own resources, traveling, teaching, doing all these things that's going to catch up, because the older I get, I'm aging out of being able to make any money anyways, as far as personally and picking up jobs and stuff, because you can hire two young kids for one old guy.
Yeah, no, we have there's a lot of need, that's for sure, in Louisiana, and we still have a lot of cold cases and a lot of people missing without their vehicles. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's the thing. Anybody that listens to your podcast and says, you know what, we had a person went missing, their car's missing, we've never found them. We don't have mountains to fall off of here. Now, we do have woods, and a lot of times we'll find suicides that will drive off in the woods somewhere, and that's it. But you'd be surprised of the areas where there's a place you could drive off or a boat launch that you could go into and just on accident or on purpose that, you know, if they're out there, you know, get in touch with me and say, this is what I've got. I can find out some questions from you, have you go look at a few things. Or I may have a resource in those areas that I can say, hey, you're over there already. Can you check that? And hopefully I can train enough of my replacements that this won't just die with me. It'll continue on in these different agencies and get them up to speed to where we have less cars in bayous because we have ways to find them.
Well said.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Amazing people under the radar. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you all for having me on. This has been really good.